Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Sam, thank you so much for joining us on our continued deep dive into the little tech agenda. I've been talking about it so much, I can't even pronounce it anymore.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah, so you are a man that probably has more hats than a haberdashery. I mean, you've got national security you can dive into, innovation policy. You write about Kant. I mean, I don't know where the bounds of your intellect end. So I'm really excited to discuss what may be missing in the little tech agenda from your vantage point. But I wanted to get your gut reaction to one of the guiding principles, according to the American Innovators Network, on what the little tech agenda is all about. And their quote is, I want to make sure I get it right, greatness starts in a garage. Thoughts?
Well, often that's the case. I mean, it's often easier to innovate when a lot of things haven't been innovated yet, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there are some famous stories of this, obviously, like Wozniak and Steve Jobs. Apparently, they'll clarify, it wasn't a garage, it was a three-bedroom.
You know, a little more space than just a cramped garage, maybe some AC even.
Yeah, I mean, today, innovation starts behind a computer screen. So it's not just this sort of archetype of the small entrepreneur, but it's like literally anybody can be an entrepreneur these days. And what defines, you know, a small business or a startup is actually getting quite hazy.
Yeah. Well, and one of the aspects I want to start with first is just this idea of little tech in and of itself, where traditionally when we're talking about innovation, we like to prioritize the innovators themselves, the folks who are coming up with that brand new invention. Everyone knows about Einstein. Everyone knows about Franklin. But something you've written on in the Techno-Industrial Policy Playbook is what I'm going to refer to as little manufacturing.
Sure, yeah.
Tell us about
Mittelstand. It's the German word.
Oh, you're going to say that one more time, and I'll pretend that I got it right. Say it one more time.
Mittelstand? I think so.
Okay, all right, German, who knows? Yeah, tell me more.
Well, this, I mean, part of you're referring to is work I've done and written about in the context of the Small Business Administration. So the Small Business Administration is our federal agency for funding small businesses through loans, through, in some cases, grants, technical assistance. But, you know, it draws out this distinction between what you could think of as sort of transformational entrepreneurship, right? The kind of Elon Musks of the world, the Steve Jobs and Wozniaks, people inventing new things, versus like the nail salon, the coffee shop, the Main Street kind of small business, which historically, SBA has done both, but is, you know, much more associated with the latter. And this wasn't always the case. So the SBA has a program called Small Business Investment Corporations, which are kind of state-licensed VCs. And they've been credited as actually spurring the U.S. venture capital industry, right? And they are, you know, often heavily invested in manufacturing. But the issue is that since, you know, they're kind of a victim of their own success, because now we have a big and beautiful venture capital industry, lots of tech money, you know, big public markets. And so what are those things for anymore? They've sort of outgrown, you know, their utility. And so there's a question, like, how can we repurpose some of these authorities that exist latent within the SBA to move beyond, you know, not just small business, but also thinking about like young business, right? A business that starts small, but has aspirations to be a big business, which I think is part of the undercurrent of the little tech agenda, which is it's not, you know, they start small, but they have aspirations to become big, and manufacturing is a big part of that. So I mentioned the Mittelstand, which, you know, under when Rubio was chairing the Small Business Administration in 2019, I worked with their team on this stuff, and they were really interested in trying to learn from the German model, because in the 2000s, when Germany was, you know, in the 90s, Germany was a sick man of Europe, and then in the 2000s, they sort of had this comeback story driven by their small and medium manufacturing base, which became known as the Mittelstand miracle. Mittelstand means like small medium business.
You learn something new every day, including German. And I think what's important about that broadening of perspective too is a couple things. Number one, learning not only from our history of how have we seen prior administrations, for example, focus on fostering innovation and prior agencies when it's worked well in terms of seeding innovation and encouraging this sort of development, but also looking abroad to Germany, to others, of trying to get what are the secrets of this success, because seeding innovation these days has become so complex. And what I like about your perspective is, yes, we have little tech and we should foster that and encourage that, but you also have to think about who's building the garage or who's building the warehouse and who's making these supplies plentiful and cheap and abundant.
Right, the whole supply chain, even like a company like General Motors is, you know, supported by a massive network of small, medium manufacturers across the country, across the world. And so even when we look at these sort of big companies, they're really kind of central nodes in massive supply chains. And this is especially true in manufacturing, in a scenario where like traditional venture capital has avoided because of the higher rates of return and multiples and like software as a service companies and so on, you know, building the next Facebook. But as that part of the market kind of saturated, like we're not going to have another Instagram or Facebook moment, you know, and also in the context of like, you know, post COVID, dealing with supply chain bottlenecks and so on, this rediscovery of, you know, a kind of patriotic purpose that like VC and Silicon Valley owes its origin to the Defense Department and early investments, and then B, that we can transcend and try to transcend just this purely software, you know, bits versus atoms kind of approach. And now, you know, in some cases aided by software, you know, software has gotten so good that it's suddenly possible to turn, you know, manufacturing hardware companies into kind of quasi software companies, and open up like new lines for investment.
Yeah. And it's interesting to see the kind of dual function of little manufacturing. I'm not going to test my German any further than I already have and embarrass myself, because as you noted, it's not only a national security question now of thinking, okay, are we reliant on an adversary for a key component of manufacturing, but also thinking about just economic resiliency. And so can you speak a little bit more about why it's so important to have little manufacturing or smaller and medium-sized manufacturing as opposed to just massive firms trying to solve all these issues?
Well, I think we need both, but you know, it's just a matter of fact that even under the current like equilibrium, like you can get to hundreds of millions or billions of users with Facebook, but like a manufacturer that's making, you know, some very precise component that goes into some very precise piece of microelectronics, you know, they are doing one thing extremely well and are a critical piece of that supply chain where, you know, maybe, you know, in some hypothetical world where we try to reshore Apple, you know, the which I don't think is possible or even desirable, but if we try to do something like that, like, there's probably literally thousands of components that we'd have to like reproduce, right? And not just reproduce like good enough, but like be state of the art at. And you know, there are obviously areas where that are more critical than others. So, you know, there's this discussion around, you know, how drones are changing warfare, for instance. I think in Ukraine, we're spending on the average of $2,000 per drone using US produced components, but the Ukrainians and Russians are also using lots of Chinese components, which bring the cost down to like $300 to $600, right? And because China has massive batteries, massive, you know, microelectronics infrastructure. And so, you know, if we did go to war, God forbid, with China or some other country, like the question is like, are they going to continue selling us those things? Or, you know, it's one thing to have like an Anduril or some of these new, you know, defense manufacturing companies, but it's, you know, I think Ukrainians are going through 50,000 drones a month, right? So it's more a matter of like crappy thing that you can produce a lot of than having the super state of the art thing that gets like defense procurement officers excited, right?
Right. It's yeah, can't wait to spend more money. It's so fascinating to think through also the difficulties of reshoring. So mm-hmm. with respect to semiconductors, for example, and trying to build out a huge warehouse in or fab farm in Phoenix or outside of Phoenix with TSMC, you know, when you talk to folks on the ground there, you have a lot of public opposition of saying, oh, we're going to have this massive warehouse, for example. There's been some cultural issues of folks who perhaps have never lived in the godforsaken Arizona summer. And I can say that because my wife is from Arizona and I refuse to visit from May to basically October. And trying to replicate that scale quickly by just dropping a new plant in some location, well, it may work out. It's going to be hard and it's worth pursuing most likely in a lot of contexts. But to your point, if you have that resiliency and redundancy already built into your manufacturing sector, you're probably going to be in a stronger economic and national security position.
Yeah, and also those communities could be stronger, mm-hmm. right? You know, where I grew up, there was one Michelin plant that made tires, right? And every other person was, you know, their dad worked at the Michelin plant. And then since I've left, you know, there's, I think there were three in the province, one from Canada, and one of them shut down, and it's just like devastating, right? And you see similar stories with, you know, offshoring furniture factories in North Carolina, or you know, the move of manufacturing from the north to the south and creating the Rust Belt. But when you have, you know, multiple of these factories or multiple of these industries that are, you know, viable within the country, it creates more resiliency, not just for like our national security and for our supply chain, but also for those communities. So they're not dependent on the sort of one mono factory.
And I'm going to ask you now to put on one of your different hats. so that community aspect to me is really important and perhaps one of the more underappreciated aspects of the little tech agenda. And now I'm going to make that an umbrella term for just little everything, little manufacturing, little small businesses. I guess that's redundant. Little tech. Having entrepreneurs in your community and having those small firms, why is that so important to a sort of strong community mentality?
Well, it imports a level of dynamism and change, right? So, you know, I this isn't manufacturing related, but when I was a kid, I was really into software, video games, animation. And for whatever reason, there was a EA, Electronic Arts studio in the county.
That is history's mysteries. How did they end up in Nova Scotia? That's fascinating.
Yeah. So, but I mean, just having like that exposure, you know, mm-hmm. People would be surprised. Like there's, I think maybe a myth that, you know, all this talent is in the coasts or you have to be in Boston or something like that. If you want to do biotech, like there's a huge amount of talent across the country that's completely like underrated and potential arbitrage opportunities, right, for businesses. And part of it is like they need the incentive. Obviously, there's some like, you know, winner take all style network effect businesses like software where everyone's going to do that in the Valley. But for manufacturing, I think one of the really cool things about it is it's kind of not so geographically, you know, specific. You can build things where the human capital is, and also you can take folks and create human capital that didn't exist already, because oftentimes these, you know, these are skilled jobs, but they're not the sort of thing where you need like a math PhD. You can take people and ordinary people. And this is part of, I think, the ancillary benefit is filling out like labor market opportunities for sort of the great middle of the country.
Yeah, it's funny you mention the sort of investment in the community itself in terms of community outreach and community building. When I go on my very specific lap around Town Lake in Austin, part of that is a baseball field. And along the fence, you don't see brought to you by Google or this team sponsored by Meta, right? It's like Franklin's Barbecue or it's Tony's real estate agency or Susie's real estate office. And you don't just get that from big tech or big anything really, because they don't have that same sense of reliance and community buy-in.
I mean, you see this in banking, especially like, right. Like they used to be able to get character loans and that doesn't really exist anymore.
No, that's for sure. That in that case, you know, I'm not sure I'd get a whole lot of loans, but that's another conversation. So with respect also to that investment in communities, I think one theory I've been working through, and I'm excited I get to chat through it with you, is in the future of a world with AGI or super intelligence or any real gains in a lot of the emerging technology fields we're discussing, my hunch is that we may not have, especially in far-flung places of the country, in the flyover states, and I say that as someone who's lived in many flyover states, we may not have massive employers who you can rely on as your, I'm going to be here for 30 years, they're going to be a pension, and everything's going to work out, and I've got health insurance through them. I kind of imagine a world in which, you know, you are doing bespoke individual tasks for one AI startup. Then the next week, you're maybe working for some biotech company and you do a couple things for them. And it just keeps going and going and going. So in the course of a year, you may have 30, 40 different employers. And that just upends our traditional notion of kind of employment and Social Security and insurance and all these things. And so I'm eager to hear from you how we can start to think about what community means in a far more technology-driven world where we're all perhaps using Neuralink, we're all perhaps interacting with an AI tutor. How do we keep space for human-to-human interactions and really building that strong sense of kinship with others?
Right. Obviously, there's a huge amount of uncertainty over what like a post-AGI, post-superintelligence world looks like. Like maybe, you know, maybe we're not doing a bunch of gig jobs in the first place. But
I'll have Daniel Picatello write a report for me later on. Yeah.
Yeah. It seems superintelligence itself is less far-fetched than I think like us all being like data annotators or something like that. But, you know, one hopeful trend, hopeful vision, and I'll put this out as like a forecast, but something that is at least something we could steer towards, is the ways in which very powerful AI enable a kind of relocalization, right? So, you know, you mentioned AI tutors. There's this long-term structural trend in education from like the 1800s to today, where we went from, you know, the one-room schoolhouse on your street to big consolidated school districts with like standardized curricula, and you'd be bused from an hour away. And that was driven by, you know, economies of scale, by urbanization, by, you know, having the economies of like everyone learning one's standard curriculum, and also like Bommel's cost disease, labor costs keep going up. And so, but, you know, if we all have AI tutors, you know, maybe that unbundles, right? And suddenly it becomes viable to raise your family in a relatively rural area with you know, maybe a dozen other families and have, you know, your one room schoolhouse again, and the AI do like the math and science from, you know, morning to noon, and then like the rest of the day be like jujitsu or archery or something fun. And you see this sort of pattern in a lot of AI. So, you know, even manufacturing like could potentially relocalize dramatically. You know, the fact that we all have doctors in our pockets now, you know, GPT without borders is a doctor without borders, right? So, you know, my hope, and I think we have to get a lot of things right. You know, we have to not all die from like some bio attack first. But like
fingers crossed, let's not do that.
Yeah, if we navigate through this, you know, what I've sometimes called like the narrow corridor, you know, it's a world that in some ways looks like history running in reverse, but with like cooler stuff and like cures for diseases and things like that. And we can go back to a way of living, a sort of form of life that is more communitarian, more sort of fitted to human nature.
Yeah, and I think that's such a powerful message, because my hunch is that among a lot of, let's say, tech skeptics, is anything that amounts to an innovation in technology, especially if we think it's only being built by San Francisco residents and New Yorkers, is something that moves us away from those sorts of communitarian or traditional values. And yet, as you're mapping out, and as I've talked to folks like Mackenzie Price, she created Alpha School. Alpha School, in many ways, is exactly what you've discussed. In Austin, in Miami, there are students who attend Alpha School. They go for about 2.5 hours, 3 hours, just engaging with an AI tutor. They learn things way faster than their peers in traditional schools, and they spend the rest of the time doing community projects, starting businesses. One of them created a documentary that's been going viral. And so the possibility of using tech to get back to good things, things that traditionally have been thought of as pro-social and good for human development, is really exciting, but I just don't think gets the attention or airwaves it deserves.
Yeah, and in some ways it's like the background factor behind, you know, what sometimes been called like the malaise of modernity, or, you know, the kind of Nietzschean last man, like we have all this abundance, but we're missing purpose. And part of it is because just the economic forces, the opportunity costs have guided us in ways that like leave us more deracinated, more like detached and unrooted. You know, speaking as someone who moved countries.
Yes. Yeah. It's okay. You're welcome. I think that the other aspect too, and I'd love your 2 cents on this, would be it's really hard to do that root and stem reevaluation of some of our institutions. So for example, public schools or any school where we have a one-to-many teacher-to-student conception of what's a classroom look like, someone standing up, giving a lecture, and everyone listening. That's just been the way we've done it, and it's, for some people, Yeah, it's nuts. I was in a middle school class with 2 teachers to 60 students. it was basically recess all day because you were just climbing over kids. But that's a whole nother conversation. I think that the possibility, though, of saying, oh, I'm going to put an AI tutor in front of this student, there's such a degree of hesitation of, whoa, I don't trust that. I've never experienced it. And so you've written on this as well. Again, a new hat for you. The importance of learning by doing for new technology. What do you mean by that? What's it look like?
Yeah, in some ways, just bridges back to like the Mittelstein stuff. I think there's...
It all goes back to Germany somehow. Yeah.
It's coincidental, I guess. There's, I think, a sense in which, you know, especially like post-Enlightenment, where we divided, you know, science as like this thing we do, you know, in theory, right? We sit behind an armchair and theorize about physics, or, you know, we develop models, and, you know, maybe in the context of like modern technology, we do like the research and design, but someone else does the manufacturing, right? You know, NVIDIA designs the chips, TSMC actually makes the thing. You know, that goes back to what in the 90s was called like the open innovation model, that with, you know, globalization taking off, the America would move up the value chain by, you know, having the IP, by having the researchers and the engineering, the manufacturing be done somewhere else, because it's the innovation happens on the front end, not on the back end. But in matter of fact, you know, innovation is always happening, and actually most like accumulated innovation happens sort of on the job while you're like tinkering with the solar panel and figuring out which mix of chemicals like produces more efficiency. And that stuff is embedded. It's all tacit. It's within what Brad DeLong used to call a community of manufacturing excellence, right? Mm-hmm. When we offshored, we didn't just lose jobs. We lost sort of those manufacturing communities, and with it, like sort of embedded forms of knowledge that, you know, generated, you know, that helped, you know, in China's case, move down the learning curve on solar and these other novel technologies, because they were building the thing itself and learning by doing and actually figuring out like tinkering. And if you segment too much like the scientists and researchers from the actual people doing the thing, you break that feedback loop, and something we have to somehow learn to reconcile.
Yeah, it's sad to me that so many of us now, we can't even navigate a city without looking at a phone, right? You won't bother to learn that there's actually a grid system. And if you just learn two principles of the streets move this direction and that way, and they go up this way and the other direction, you can probably find wherever you're going. But losing that knowledge is not only sad, I think if we apply that principle further and think through, you know, what does it mean for critical thinking skills in the age of AI, and with respect to some of these new technologies like biotech, if I can just purchase, better legs or a better brain, what does that mean for who I am as a person and who we are as a society with respect to grappling with difficult things or engaging in fun tasks and having to go through training? There's just so many things that we actually have to experience to master it and to get something out of it.
Yeah, and I think it's beyond just like being able to Google something. I forget where I heard this example, but apparently, we all hear that like tech executives like keep screens away from their kids, like ironically. But there's also some that will, you know, write longhand, right? Or, you know, insist on like doing the mock-up with a sketch pad, because there really is a thing where, you know, if you're doing like the drafting, like with, you know, you learn how to draw, you learn how to, you know, you learn perspective, that this actually like builds circuitry in your brain that like creates you, you know, gives you better like spatial reasoning ability, so on and so forth. And so like, you know, we do have to, I think that the challenge with the modern era is a lot of these constants have become variables, and it suddenly becomes like something we have to choose to like put away the phone after, you know, midnight or whatever, so we can fall asleep. One of my hopes is that, you know, again, in the more positive vision, that like very powerful AI could serve as a kind of, like tandem partner to help you stay on the path and correct some of these like more addicting elements of like social media and things like that. You know, imagine if, you know, I sometimes joke, you know, Oprah could afford to pay someone a full-time salary to like slap the donut out of her hand, right? Yes. But like, if you could,
I would take that job, Oprah, for what it's worth. Let me slap your donut.
Right. So like our capacity for self-control is in many ways like embedded in the environment. Like whether, you know, this is why addicts need a peer group to, you know, keep them honest and stuff like that. Right. But like, if we can have some of that become embedded with like agential like intelligence, then in some ways we become more aligned with like our like lower and higher order desires, right?
Well, and to bring this sort of full circle to little tech and to encouraging smaller firms to be pursuing these innovations, I think there's a sense of, if you have, for example, that local AI company, which is something we don't really say right now, of like, oh yeah, my mom and pop AI company, they can be more attuned to the customs and culture and norms and values of a community and bake that into some of their products. There's a common saying among a lot of kind of the AI community that you are going to see values baked into a model, and those implicit values will come out the more you engage with it. And for some people, that brings just concern and outrage of, I don't want my kids using what, you know, Sam Altman thinks is a good way of living life. But if you know that Sam from down the street was the person who made that model, maybe things would change and you would encourage your kids to use those tools. And so it's fun to think about that shift.
Yeah, we're not going to have the mom and pop AI company, but like, we also don't have the mom and pop utility company, right? And so like, AI, to the extent that it is a general purpose technology, it's a lot more like electricity. And we have companies right now that are trying to make the most like smartest, like, you know, tokens that we can pump into our products. But, you know, in the short run, at least, what it's done is like empower small business owners to, you know, have, you know, world class marketing materials when there may be two people, right? Or to be able to, you know, have, you know, an accountant or legal services or other things that they would never be able to afford. And so it's created this opportunity for like a long tail of, you know, genuine brick and mortar stores to sort of make a bit of a comeback, hopefully, all the way down to like the individual, right? It's less that AI is going to destroy all software jobs or, you know, we're at FedSoc, all legal jobs. Instead, I think what it's going to do is like make us all software developers and all lawyers and all accountants. Mm-hmm. And that it puts an incredible amount of power in one person's hands, but also means that like, if you do have a passion, if you do want to like do, you know, something artistic or, you know, make a cupcake shop for your local community, suddenly you have like all these resources at your fingertips, and it dramatically lowers the barrier to entry. Mm-hmm.
And I think it's cool also to think about a world in which having that maybe hyper-local focus in some instances, if we think about having smaller entities that folks are more familiar with that are slightly more trustworthy, hopefully, or just by virtue of familiarity, right? I think that maps onto some aspects of your learning by doing as well, where I've noticed that the second I go to a law conference and folks say, how do I use AI? What do I do? Whatever. The second I show a demonstration of just, hey, here's a state Supreme Court opinion you're confused about. Let's do a quick query to get the key takeaways and to explain it or to translate it into basic terms. And it's just, you know, the scales fall from the eyes and they realize, wow, it didn't, you know, cause the building to blow up or something like that. And I think also with respect to the blockchain in particular, this is just something that Colin mentioned from A16Z about when you look at the overall usage of blockchain, it's not like everyone's using it to do pig scams, right? It's not like it's fundamentally the only use case is actually to just corrupt people and to maximize evil intentions. But you have to see that use case live or know someone who's done that. And if you don't have that learning by doing, then it seems like the usual response is just distrust.
Right. It's also misusing the tool, right? And you see this generationally where like young people who, you know, maybe they're 18, 19 today, you know, they've, you know, ChatGPT came out in, I guess, 2022. You know, I think GPT-3 was 2020. So, you know, they've had years now with these tools in varying degrees of like capability, but you know, they've gotten used to it and they understand that like you use it differently, right? I remember a colleague of mine, an older colleague of mine, not to throw shade, but like we were testing an early AI, I think it was maybe GPT-4, and she wanted to know, you know, what it thought about ancient Latin art history or something like that, and you know, it gave a kind of rote response, but she, you know, using it sort of like a Google replacement rather than like understanding that these tools unlock new kinds of use cases and, you know, have very different, you know, modes of best practices for, you know, how to use them. And so I think kids get that partly because they do learn by doing. I mean, in some level, all education has always been self-education. But if you go into a new tool and try to use it in an old way, you will leave disappointed or distrusting it. Or, you know, you've heard these cases of like lawyers, you know, submitting briefing documents that are full of like fake case law, right? They're treating it like it's like LexisNexis or something like that, but they haven't made the leap to like this works differently and, you know, to use it differently.
Right, right. And it goes, it makes me think of, you know, you're not going to use a skateboard to say, oh, let's go on a cross-country road trip. Right. Grab your board, man. No one ever says that. And yet folks, when they're first introduced to ChatGPT, for example, will say, oh, write a brief.
Right.
Well, it's not going to write a coherent piece of legal doctrine or anything like that. And well, you just have to, yeah it'll write, it'll be coherent. It will not be at all correct in any fashion. So I want to know how you, you know, doing this series, we've heard a lot of perspectives. We've heard a lot of people who are pretty vehement about their position being the right one, or feeling like, you know, the other side is just fundamentally missing something. You, speaking of all of your different hats, seem to be able to, and this is going to sound wild, hold multiple ideas and perspectives at a single time. And so how do you do that? What do you think about when you think about thinking about things? As a very, very good question I just asked.
You know, one of the reasons I moved down here in the first place was to go to George Mason. I was a big fan of like Tyler Cowen and that whole ecosystem at GMU's econ department. And, you know, Tyler Cowen talks about, you know, meta rationality, right? So, you know, maybe Enlightenment 1.0 was like Descartes, and we're all going to, you know, be rational and think rational thoughts. But it turns out that doesn't work very well because we, you know, we are a slave to the passions, as David Hume said. So, you know, meta rationality is just like acknowledging that, you know, I do have these biases, and like, what am I going to do to correct those biases? You know, how do I catch myself, or can I adopt certain practices that, like, you know, if I feel myself leaning too heavily into one direction, can I lean the other direction? So, you know, I've sort of taken that to heart. I also, you know, I think that there's just a lot of uncertainty, especially in some of these topics like AI. I'm very suspicious of anybody who thinks like the 99% chance we're all going to die, or 99% chance it's all going to go well, both because there's motivated reasoning, but also because like no one really knows. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you hear people say like, you know, there's a 10% chance of this and a 20% chance of this. And if you practice that kind of like probabilistic kind of thinking, then it forces you to like have some cognitive dissonance, because you're not putting all your probability mass on one thing. You know, Daniel Kahneman's stuff, been influential on that, Phil Tetbach and super forecasting. The people who are really good at forecasting are able to say like, you know, there's X amount of percent chance this is going to happen, but like there's also a chance that the total opposite thing happens. And to the person on the street, you know, they may say, well, you're just holding contradictory worldviews, but like, you know, it's like playing poker. If you're, you know, if you put someone on a pair of cards, you could say, well, you know, I know for sure you have, you know, the nut flush or something like that. But like the best poker players are ones that say, you know, there's a 10% chance you have it, and you know, my odds aren't good enough. And so bringing in that more like, I don't know, probabilistic ways of thinking definitely is part of the secret.
Yeah. Well, and you gave us a lot of homework with a heck of a lot of good reading there. And in terms of thinking about that broader homework and that broader approach to thinking through things at through multiple perspectives and at many levels, what are there any remaining things about the little tech agenda you wish were brought up more frequently, or that you feel like are omitted from these sorts of conversations about innovation policy generally?
Yeah, I mean, I support like little tech broadly construed. I do have questions about, to the extent it has become a bit of a marketing term, to be honest. Like, and not for bad reasons. You know, there was a huge, like, what was called the tech lash, especially around like 2014, 2015, where, you know, I think Facebook changed the algorithm, and suddenly journalists all around the country started hating big tech for, again, motivated reasoning. And so I think we can get back to a world where we're just pro tech, period, like big and small. Not try to predict, you know, what the market structure is going to be. And, there's roles for antitrust and things like this here and there. But like, ultimately, we're concerned about like, what benefits the average American, you know, what is our standard of living, our consumption, are we growing? And, you know, every economic model I'm aware of that makes sense of the real world, like involves both big players and small players. You know, big companies that are able to do like the R&D labs and make the massive data center investments or what have you. And then the small players that are always sort of nipping at their heels. And if we don't have that balance, that ecosystem balance, it sort of throws the whole economy out of whack and gets us locked in some kind of stagnation. And that's the biggest thing we need to avoid.
Right. And I think too, realizing that we have some agency with respect to the direction of technology. For me, the sort of hyper techno skepticism or even pessimism kind of reflects a lack of creativity of saying, well, if we're fearful of this development going wrong, we can do something about it, right? We live in a society in which if we collectively want to steer something in a different route, absent, you know, black swan events, it's within our capacity to move it in that direction. And I think it's just realizing your perceived lack of will or power is your own perception, right? And you can change that perception.
Yeah, I mean, this is the Peter Thiel makes this point a lot about, you know, optimism and pessimism both leading to inaction, right? Excess optimism and excess pessimism. And there's a lot of truth to that. Like if you think everything is predetermined, like a Calvinist or something like that, like you're going to just like be fatalistic, but you also think that everything is chaos and in flux and there's nothing that we can do, you get the same result. And so what is, and I think this is just what's true, is that there are mixtures of both. Like there's things that we do control. We don't know the limits of our agency, but there's no really way of finding out other than like trying.
So. Right. Well, one final question for you, one final hat, asking you to take the role of prognosticator. 5 years from now, what are we going to be saying about the little tech agenda?
Oh gosh, 5 years is a long time with the rate of change right now. You know, my hope is that there are very powerful forces in AI that resemble similar of the forces of big tech that gave rise to the Googles of the world. Because if you are able to train, you know, the N+1 model with billions and billions of dollars and billions and billions of dollars in investment, you could reap outsized rewards. And so my hope is that in this context, there still is a little tech agenda because we've thought hard and deeply about what that kind of power concentration could entail. So.
Wow. All right. Well, challenge accepted for society. Sam, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's REGproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.